Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. Frances Dinkelspiel has a great story to tell, and she found it in her own family history. Or at least she found that history in more than 50,000 pieces of paper stored in 40 cartons at the California Historical Society in downtown San Francisco. What she has woven together of those documents is a fascinating history of her great-grandfather, Isaias Wolf Hellman, and as well a great history of late 19th and early 20th century California. Isaias Hellman went from being a poor immigrant to being one of the wealthiest and most powerful men of the West. You will be amazed at how many institutions that you're already familiar with throughout the state to which Isaias Hellman played a direct role. And who knows what he would think of our current budget crisis. You can ask Frances that question. Frances is a fifth-generation Californian. She grew up in San Francisco. She's a graduate of Stanford and the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. She spent more than 20 years in the newspaper business, working as a general assignment reporter on a range of topics and papers. Her freelance work has appeared in the New York Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, the Miami Herald, and many other publications. And her book, which she'll discuss tonight with Bill Devereaux, Towers of Gold, How One Jewish Immigrant Named Isaias Hellman Created California, is the product of a decade-long journey to discover the details of her great-grandfather's amazing business career. In conversation with Frances tonight is Bill Devereaux, one of the great scholars of California and the West. He is a professor of history at USC, where he specializes in the history of California and the American West, and directs a scholarly institute where he collaborates with the Huntington Library in Pasadena. He is the author of Whitewashed Adobe, The Rise of Los Angeles, and the Remaking of Its Mexican Past, and Railroad Crossing, Californians and the Railroad, 1850 to 1910. With Greg Heiss, he's the co-author of Eden by Design, the 1930 Olmsted-Bartholomew Plan for the Los Angeles region. And I'm afraid for the next year we're losing Bill to New Haven, Connecticut, but he promises he won't stay away much longer than that. He's very important to this community, and I guess we'll share him for a year if we have to. For right now, please welcome Bill Devereaux and Frances Dinkelspiel to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Well, good evening, everyone. Thanks, Louise, for the introduction. It's always a pleasure to be here at Allowed for another wonderful program put on by these great folks here at the library. This is my old friend from college, Frances Dinkelspiel. We went to college together 2 years ago. it's nice to be back and see her. Those of you who wander in the fields of California history, particularly of the latter 19th century's gold rush period forward, it's not unlikely that you've encountered in your own work or curiosity I.W. Hellman. He is one of those figures who seems to be everywhere on maps and in the business histories of California and the institutional histories of California. And just a little bit of work leads to other sightings of him in the historical record. And yet he's one of those remarkably interesting figures about which there seemed to be very, very little known until this book and this author. So I want to just start with Frances asking her about her own family history and about how she first heard of this man in the living room or kitchen or basements of her own home. Frances.
Okay, thank you, Bill. It's good to be here. One of the nice byproducts of writing this book is I've gotten to spend a lot of time in L.A., and I grew up in San Francisco, and as many of you may or may not know, when you're a San Franciscan, you generally sort of look down on Los Angeles. There's this, Southern California, who wants to go there? But I am happy to report that's not true at all, and I've been pleasantly delighted in Los Angeles. In fact, I quite love it. So I'm a fifth-generation Californian, and I grew up always knowing that my family had something to do with Wells Fargo Bank. But I didn't really know what that was, and I didn't really care, actually. I was like most kids. I was much more interested in playing with my cousins, one of whom sits over there, than talking to my older relatives or my parents about my family's legacy. And it really wasn't until my 13th birthday that I started to understand that my family had a special relationship with Wells Fargo Bank. My parents had decided to give me a checking account for my birthday, and I took the bus downtown to meet my father, and we went out to lunch at this old San Francisco restaurant called the Old Poodle Dog, and afterwards we walked to the main branch of Wells Fargo Bank, where he introduced me to this elderly gentleman sitting at a desk. And the man reached into his desk and pulled out this credit card-sized card on thick white cardstock that had this gold stagecoach embossed on it. And he wrote my name down and handed it to me, and he said, "Francis, this is your identification for your checking account. Don't lose it." And I still remember sort of the reaction I got when I pulled out this card. I went down to my local branch of Wells Fargo, and I wrote out a check, and I presented my check with the card to the teller. Now, this was back a long, long time ago when a lot of teenagers didn't have checkbooks. And it was sort of the 70s, and so I had, the grunge look was my specialty. And so I presented this check to the teller, and instead of sort of looking at me and sort of, motioning over for her boss to come and see who this kid was, she was incredibly gracious. She handed over my money right away and gave me a big smile, and I remember thinking, wow, this is really cool. I like this. And so for me, that was the first indication that my family had this interesting relationship with Wells Fargo Bank.
How did you connect, or did you connect, even in your upbringing and family conversations, that special relationship to I.W. Hellman?
How did I connect it? I mean, further
on? Were you aware of him growing up in your household and that was the root of that special relationship?
Yes, I always knew that Isaias Hellman had been here a long time and that he had owned Wells Fargo Bank was what I had known. But that was sort of about the extent of it.
And then when you, before you started on this book, you had this career as a journalist. We were college mates together. You went off to graduate school at Columbia. Did you ever imagine you'd write history or biography?
No. I was a history major in college. That's how we knew each other. And I loved history. We went to Stanford. And I thought maybe I'd pursue history. But when I was a senior, there was a terrible tenure battle over a favorite professor, which was very revealing in sort of how it showed me how political sort of the academic world was. And I thought, the reporter's world, it isn't that political. I'll just go do that instead. So.
Okay, now how do you get from there and that naivete to a position where you're going to tackle this relatively unknown but obviously very important figure?
Well, I was a newspaper reporter for many years, and I decided that I wanted to try my hand at a different kind of writing. So I took a leave of absence from my newspaper, and I decided I was going to write some personal essays. And as I wrote these essays, I thought that they would be enhanced if I incorporated a little bit of family history in them. And I had heard that the papers of Isaias Hellman, who's my great-great-grandfather, were down at the Historical Society. So I took Bart in. At this point, I have children. I'm married. I'm living in Berkeley. And I went to the archivist, and I said, I'd like to see the papers of Isaias Hellman. And she said, well, of course you can see the papers, but which box would you like to see? And I said, what do you mean, which box? And she said, well, we have 40 boxes of Isaias Hellman documents, about 50,000 pieces of paper. Now, they don't call me brilliant for anything, for no reason. And so I thought, okay, what can you answer? What's the response to that question? So I said, okay, I'll start with box number one. So she pulled out the box, and I opened up a folder, and the first thing I saw was something that looked like a report card from Germany from the 1850s. And then the second thing I saw was something that looked like a land contract from Los Angeles in the 1860s. And then there was a letter from a guy named Herman, who was in Wilmington, who thanked Isaias for lending him this book, and it was a real relief because, as you know, there's nothing to do in Wilmington. And so for me, like, immediately I got really, really interested in what these papers were. And I started to look through them, and I was amazed at the names that kept popping off these pieces of paper. Names of people like Collis Huntington, who was one of the builders of the Transcontinental Railroad, Levi Strauss of the Jeans Company, Meyer Lehman of Lehman Brothers, Harrison Gray Otis, Edward Doheny, Charles Canfield, and so on and so on, John Downey. And the more I look through these papers, the more I realize that these people were Isaias Hellman's business partners and that there was a really interesting story in here. And so I quickly decided that, although I found myself extremely interesting, I realized that my personal essays were not going to be anywhere as interesting as the life of Isaias Hellman. And so I decided at that point that I would write a book about him.
Tell us a little bit about the arc of his life. You know, the arrival here, that group he came with, that small, close-knit group, what he found when he was here, and then just arc his life out for us briefly across the decades.
Okay. So Isaias Hellman was born in Reckendorf, Bavaria. He was Jewish, which was very important because Jews in Germany at that point were not accorded full citizenship. And they were very restricted in their movements and their occupations and who they could marry and where they could live. And there was a slight flowering with Napoleon, a loosening of laws against Jews, but then there was a clampdown. And that clampdown prompted a huge exodus of Jews from Central Europe. And Hellman was among that group who left Central Europe. But while most people settled on the East Coast, New York or New Orleans, Hellman came out to California. And he joined a group of Jews and people from all around the world who'd come to California in search of riches from gold.
And he's a teenager.
He's a teenager. He's 15 years old. He comes with his younger brother, Herman. There's just the two of them. They arrive in San Francisco after a long journey across the isthmus, but they don't stay in San Francisco. They get on the steamer, and they immediately come down to Los Angeles. And they arrive March 31st, 1859. They come to Wilmington. You know, there's really nothing in Wilmington. And the first thing they have to do is get on a stage from Wilmington to Los Angeles. And at that point, there was a lot of competition for business between the port and the city. There were two competing stage companies, and they used to race down the roads. And there were terrible roads, so it was like this rattling experience. And it was, you know, even more dreadful than, you know, probably coming all the way from Europe. So Hellman arrived, and he went to work as a clerk in his cousin's dry goods store. And he saved up his money, and he opened his own dry goods store. And he eventually got into banking. And he eventually opened something called the Farmers and Merchants Bank, which was the really first successful bank in Los Angeles. He opened it with a man named John Downey, who'd been the governor of California. And it was actually very critical to the development of Los Angeles, because prior to that, well, one thing I hadn't mentioned is banks were illegal in California in 1859. When California became a state, since it had been founded on gold, the creators of the state constitution decided that the state could be run on gold, that they didn't need banks, that no one needed banks, so they outlawed banks. And that didn't mean people didn't open banks. It just meant that they were completely unregulated. So someone would hang their shingle up saying, "I'm a banker." Someone would come and put their gold in the bank, go away, come back a week later, and the bank would be gone.
Just like today.
Just like today, exactly. anyway, so Hellman and Downey started the Farmers and Merchants Bank, and it brought it helped do a lot of things, including, you know, making money reasonable to borrow, bringing money to the region. Prior to that, there was no money to buy property or to you know, build a business or whatever. You had to borrow it at a high rate of interest. He became a banker.
He's still a young man.
He was in his 20s when he opened the bank. And he went on to, do you want me to go all the way? I mean, just...
We'll get there, but you can go ahead and arc him out.
Okay.
To the pinnacle of success.
Okay, so he did a lot of other things besides banking, but I'll just focus on his banking career. So he stayed in Los Angeles until 1890. And then he moved up to San Francisco, where he took over the presidency of something called the Nevada Bank, which was also a large bank. And he ran that until 1905, when he made a deal with his pal Edward Harriman to buy Wells Fargo Bank. Harriman didn't want the banking part of the business. He just wanted the express business. And so Hellman took over Wells Fargo Bank. And so probably in the first decade of the 20th century, that was the height of Hellman's power. He was either president or served on the board of 17 banks on the Pacific Coast, and he controlled about $100 million in capital. And he really was the premier financier.
You know, there's a feature of Hellman's life that I sort of alluded to in my opening bit there. It's partly because knowing about Francis in this wonderful book, knowing about Hellman, but there's a Zelig-like quality to Hellman. If you know he's out there and you start poking around into various aspects of finance and banking and property transfers, etc., there he is. He pops up. He owns the note, or he's the banker of record, or he's loaning that kind of money. He must have had an unerring eye to be at the right place at the right time financially.
Well, I think that's probably one of the best things about my research is that I think that Hellman's role in the creation and development of the state, particularly of Southern California, had been forgotten. And so I found lots of evidence of that in the letters. I mean, for example, I found this great letter written by Harrison Gray Otis, the man who owned the LA Times. He talked about how one evening in 1886, he knocked on Hellman's door at his house on 4th and Main Street. Hellman opened it up, opened the door. Harrison Gray Otis said, "I have a problem, Mr. Hellman. I need to talk to you." Hellman invited him in, and the two men sat down in the parlor, and Otis began to explain that he was co-owner of the Los Angeles Daily Times. He was having a business disagreement with his partner, Mr. Boyce, and both of them were racing to find the funds to buy one another out. And Otis had been to a lot of different people looking for money, and no one would lend it to him. And Hellman, owning a paper back in those days was no sure thing, just like it's not today. There was a period where it was really a money maker. At the end of that conversation, Hellman said to him, there's something about you I like. I want to lend you the funds to buy out your partner. And he lent him $18,000, which enabled him to find to buy out Boyce. Now, in all the books that had been written about the rise of the LA Times, there'd always been reference to this, anonymous banker who lent the money. And so I was really happy to figure out it was Isaias Hellman.
I know you've brought some pictures to help elucidate and illustrate the period, which will be great. Before we turn to those, let me just ask you, allude to this issue that Hellman had been kind of forgotten. And I think it's entirely true. The scholarly perspective on California history knows about him, but there's very little attention to the research that one would need to do to yield to a book like this. So this is really kind of a breakthrough moment for our knowledge of Hellman. Why do you think there'd been so little written about the guy?
Well, Hellman was internationally famous in his lifetime. But since he sort of had divided his career between Los Angeles and San Francisco, I think that worked against him to some degree. Because scholars in Los Angeles, first of all, L.A. hasn't done the best job of preserving its history, especially in the late part of the 19th century. So people who went to look at L.A., if they're looking after 1890, they weren't going to see Hellman as much. And the same with San Francisco. And the other thing is Hellman was a very modest man in a funny way. He loved to build fancy houses. He liked to talk to the newspapers about his accomplishments and the state of the economy and things like that. But he didn't seek fame. He didn't seek to, put his name on things. He really thought that his actions would speak for themselves. And so I think, that's an honorable approach. But I think, California is filled with so many larger-than-life figures that they just sort of, their personalities and all the things that they did sort of crowded him out.
Let's see the pictures.
So here's a picture of Hellman when he was in his young 20s, just starting out as a banker. And I love this picture because I love the beard. And in fact, I wanted to put the beard on the cover of my book, but I got a call from my mother, and she said, "You can't put that picture on the cover of the book. He looks atrocious." But I just think I like the way he looks. So here's a picture of Los Angeles around 1870. This is Downey Block before it really was Downey Block. This is one of the main business districts of Los Angeles. So when Hellman arrived in LA in 1859, it really was more Pueblo than American City. There were about 4,000 people here. The first language spoken was Spanish. The second language spoken was French. And English was only the third most common language. There was no railroad connection between San Francisco and LA. There was no telegraph connection. And the best way to get here was by steamer from San Francisco, which only came twice a month. Here's a picture of Calle de las Negras, which is, you know, an infamous alley where there was a lot of gambling. This is the scene of the 1871 riots against the Chinese community. So here on the left, the far left, is a picture of Hellman's first bank. It was in a building owned by Pio Pico, who'd been the Mexican governor of Mexico, of California, was part of Mexico. And Hellman started a bank that was called Hellman Temple and Company. It lasted a few years, and then the Farmers and Merchants Bank moved in there. And right next door is the fanciest address in Los Angeles, the Bella Union Hotel. This is a picture of B'nai B'rith, which is the first synagogue in Los Angeles. It was built in 1873 on the corner of 2nd and what is now Broadway. So one of the things that was really interesting to find in this book was that it was the story of Jews in California, which I had never been really familiar with, and which is very different than the story of Jews on the East Coast. Because about 10,000 Jews were in California by the time Hellman arrived in 1859, and they had very different experience than Jews on the East Coast, because everyone was so interested in making money at the gold rush, they weren't interested in excluding Jews. The Californians were very open to many different groups. The exceptions were if you were African American or Chinese. And so the Jews sort of entered in and from the beginning were accepted. And there in the Los Angeles had 8 Jews in 1850. He probably had a few hundred Jews by the time Hellman arrived. And it was a small, close-knit community, and they managed to build their first synagogue in 1873. This is a picture of his wife, Esther Hellman. This is from the Seaver Center. It's not a great picture, but
also European.
She is also from Germany. She came over. Her sister was married to Meyer Lehman of Lehman Brothers, and that was a very important alliance for both Hellman and California. This is a picture of Hellman's house on the corner of 4th and Main Streets. Now, the main part of Los Angeles back in the 1870s was the Plaza. And this was about a mile from the plaza, and it was so far out of town that when Hellman brought the property, he was worried his wife would be lonely. So he bought another piece of property, and he gave it to a friend with the stipulation that the friend build a house there. So this is, not so far from here. It's 4th and Main Street, and now of the bank, the Farmers and Merchants Bank building is on it. This is just a picture of L.A., very verdant. These are the pepper trees that were so prevalent. This is a picture of his brother Herman's first house. His brother Herman, this is 4th and Hill. His brother Herman also went on to be an accomplished banker. This is a picture of Herman's family. Let's go through. Okay, this is the Farmers and Merchants Bank on Commercial and Main Street, where it stood for about 20 years. This is a picture of just an advertisement towards the Chinese community. Hellman built a store on the plaza catering to the Chinese community. So I just have this to show that there was sort of some interaction between the various ethnicities in Los Angeles back then. It was, when Hellman arrived, it was a very heterogeneous city, but the different groups really socialized and mixed with one another. Not that the Chinese mixed with the Europeans and the native-born Californians, but there was a lot of camaraderie and there wasn't as much exclusion as there would develop later. And here's a picture of Hellman.
More casual than most of the shots of him. Almost candid.
This is a picture of the Wells Fargo Bank in San Francisco before the earthquake and fire. This is his house in San Francisco. He liked big houses, so this is just an interior of his house. another interior. This is on 4th and Main Street. Some of you may recognize it. This is the building Farmers and Merchants Bank constructed in 1905. Hellman also built some office buildings around it. They've now been converted to lofts. And here's a picture of Hellman. I'll leave that one up there.
That's the cover of the book.
Yeah, that's him in his office in Los Angeles at 4th and Main Streets.
When you were doing the work, did family members, either known to you or perhaps less known to you, any family members act as repositories of family history that you could talk to?
I wasn't really able to do any oral interviews with people. There was no one alive that knew Hellman, though I tried my hardest to see if there was. But some family members had preserved some documents. And in fact, one of the things I talk about in my book was that Hellman's was very close to his brother Herman, but they had a rift in the end of their lives. And when the family donated all the papers to the California Historical Society, they removed all the letters between the two brothers that sort of shed a bad light on them. And so I went to look at my cousin's filing cabinet, and I found all these letters. She had no idea what they were, so I was able to read those.
Now, you talked a little bit about his personality in terms of a certain modesty to let his acts speak for himself or his institutions, the likes of which are in the dozens that he founded or played a role in founding. But tell us a little bit more about him. What kind of man was he?
Well, he was very, very smart. That's very clear. And he had an uncanny sort of knack for business. He made so many investments that were critical. He backed Henry Huntington in the creation of the Pacific Electric. He backed Edward Doheny and Charles Canfield in the discovery of oil, as well as the men who founded another oil company. He just really seemed to have a sense of who was going to succeed and who wasn't. Success also contributed to a bit of arrogance on his part. He was so successful and so smart that he, I think, believed that there were people out there who weren't as intelligent as him, and he sort of looked down on them. So he could be very judgmental, and sometimes that judgment extended into some of his family members, and so there are letters that are very critical that he sent to some his brother and some other people. And so I think that if there's any sort of bad part of his personality, it was that.
19th century businessmen, in the American context, generally keep their private lives extraordinarily private. You know, we can see their business demeanor and their business bearing. We learn very little about interior lives or private lives. Same with him?
Yes and no. There were some letters that were preserved written between him and his wife in German. And so I had those translated. And there was a lot of love expressed between the two of them. They had an arranged marriage. He took the Transcontinental Railroad across the country in 1870 to go meet Esther Newgass was her name. And they didn't know each other. But after a brief period of time, they decided to get married. And she must have been pretty adventurous to decide to come to Los Angeles after living in New York and Germany. And they fell deeply in love. And that was very clear in their letters. And she died prematurely. And he was very sentimental about her death. He had one letter, the last letter she'd written to him, and he wrote on the envelope, "This is the last letter my dear beloved wife ever wrote to me." And he kept it. And he had another sort of family tragedy that exploded into the public eye, which sort of revealed a lot about his interior life, which was he had a cousin named Henry Fleischman, whom he had raised and who he put in his bank and who rose to become cashier in his bank. And Hellman had a blind eye towards this man, Henry Fleischman. His brother Herman never liked Henry Fleischman, always complained about Henry Fleischman, and Isaias Hellman never listened. And then one day in December 1901, the bank officials woke up to find that Henry Fleischman had absconded with about $300,000 in the bank's money, which is the single largest embezzlement in California banking history up until that time. And the Hellmans try to sort of downplay the severity of the theft and also sort of downplay what it meant. But Hellman couldn't help himself. In many of the newspaper articles, he just sort of confessed how he really cared for this person and how he felt really betrayed. So it was a good, it was a delightful way to sort of get a sense of, he was a very loyal man and a loving man to people in his family, or certain people in his family.
It's one thing to write a chronicle of someone's life. It's another thing as a biographer, and maybe particularly as a family member, to try to get a sense of that personal life. And that's one of the things that make the book so rich. In that sense, I've never asked you this before, and with all due respect to your cousin in the audience, we can take your cousin out of the discussion for a second. Are there family members that you know now today who you think inhabit some of the same characteristics or reveal some of the same characteristics?
Oh, no. I found a letter that was written by one cousin in St. Louis to Hellman after he had the fallout with his brother. And he said that the cousin named Abe Hellman wrote, "You know that there is a reason our name is really Hellman, because we have fiery tempers." And I have to admit, I think a lot of us still have fiery tempers.
Interesting.
I mean, I know for myself, I can get angry quickly, but I also get over it really quickly. And I have a couple cousins who, and a brother who are the same way.
Tell us about the title of the book.
Okay. Towers of Gold. Well, in 1893, there was an unexpected bank panic in Los Angeles. It had to do with the U.S. talking about going off the gold system onto the silver system. And Hellman was in San Francisco, he was president of Nevada Bank, and his brother Herman was down here in Los Angeles heading up the Farmers and Merchants Bank. And sort of all of a sudden, this panic gripped Los Angeles, and hundreds of people swarmed downtown, rushed into all these different banks, and started withdrawing their money in a frenzy. And they took out so much money that the banks started to close because they didn't have enough cash. And Herman Hellman sent a telegram to Isaiah saying, "There's a bank run coming on. I think you better get down here." And Hellman sent a telegram back saying, no, we have enough money. I don't think so. Herman sent another telegram, "No, there's a problem. Come down here." Once again, Hellman sort of didn't pay attention. The third telegram said, "Citibank has closed." Then 20 minutes later, there was another telegram saying, "First National Bank has closed." And with that, Hellman realized there was a full-fledged bank panic. And there was nothing that a bank owner feared more than a bank panic, because although banks were legal in California at that time, there was no FDIC insurance deposit, there was no government backing of banks. And so a man's reputation was really the only thing he had to sell his customers. So Hellman was very, very worried, so he decided to come to Los Angeles, and he ordered that $500,000 of his own money be loaded into some rail cars from San Francisco to take down to Los Angeles. He got on this rail car. They started to head down to L.A. They made it as far as the Tehachapi Pass when the train broke down. Now, the train is, tantalizingly close to Los Angeles. There's a full-fledged panic going in L.A. People are still desperate for their money. The L.A. Times said, quote, "It was as if an alien race of people had inhabited the streets," because people were so worried about their money. Anyway, the mayor got on the phone and said, "Get that train in here." Herman Hellman got on the phone saying, "Get that train down here." Finally, the train got fixed. It pulled into the San Fernando Depot at 1 o'clock. Hellman got out of the train, and people from all over rushed down to the depot, and they watched as Hellman oversaw the unloading of sacks and sacks and sacks of gold into an armored wagon. Hellman rode up with his armored wagon to his bank on Main and Commercial Street. He went inside. He took much of the gold that he had brought, and he heaped it on the counters of the bank. He heaped it in piles and piles, in towers of gold, which is how I got the name of the book. And then they opened the doors to the bank, and people rushed in, and at the sight of all that gold, they immediately calmed down, and they realized that there was no reason to be worried, that there was enough money to go around. And with that, the bank panic throughout the city subsided. And it was a really pivotal moment for Isaias Hellman. He was sort of single-handedly was the man who came to the rescue. And so I thought it was a fitting name
Absolutely.
For the book.
Other than going through those boxes of the Historical Society, 1, 2, 3, all the way up to 40, a good research method, a clear research method. Tell us a little bit about how you did the research and how threads led to threads led to threads, because while you were researching this book, it was not uncommon to see you at the major archival repositories here in Southern California. Tell us about training yourself as an historian.
Okay. Well, I got my bachelor's in history, but that was about it. But I think my reporting background really helped a lot, because there had been no timeline developed of Hellman, no one who had pointed out the various businesses he'd been involved in. So it was really a little bit of detective work. I had to, every time I'd read a letter and there'd be a business mention, I would write down that business. And, I'd look for references to that business later on. So I would accumulate information that way. I spent months, literally months, in the basement of the Doe Library at UC Berkeley reading the old newspapers of Los Angeles. I mean, of course, it's great. Now the LA Times is on, it's digitized, so you can see a lot of information. But the Times didn't start till 1881, so you have from 1850 to 1881. So every time there was a mention of Hellman, I would write it down. And then I would go and I would research other people's documents. He was very involved with Henry Huntington, so clearly I had to look at a lot of the Huntington papers down at the Huntington Library. And I would see the other end of the correspondence from Huntington, and one end from Hellman and one end from Huntington. And so by doing it that, if you spend enough time, and believe me, I did, this was like a huge, long project, little pieces accumulate until they finally make a critical mass. And so then you're able to write about them.
How about training yourself in the financial complexity of this life? I mean, this is someone whose business involvements are just so intricate and so amazingly complicated. Do you have to train yourself in 19th century finance?
Yes, absolutely. So I did a lot of reading. I did a lot of interviewing of people who are specialists in early banking. I just also looked through the ledgers and things just as much as I could to familiarize myself with it. I mean, I don't think the book is about a banker, and it talks a lot about banking, but I think, I try to do it in sort of a general enough way that it would appeal to everybody, not just, hardcore business readers.
You made a provocative comment that I agree with as an historian of this region, but the notion that anti-Semitism, as we know it, in the latter 19th century, was more benign, and that those windows and doors about ethnic egalitarianism and equity begin to close as the century turns and we get into the 19-teens and 1920s. Why do you think that is? And also, maybe more interesting for the life of this guy, who are his friends? He's got a who's who list of business compatriots. But who's he close to?
I found this interesting letter from Harrison Gray Otis after his wife died, and I guess Hellman had written sort of a condolence note, and Otis wrote back saying, thank you for your condolence note. I love my wife, and she was always a very good friend to you, your people. And I thought that was a really interesting distinction. So, what I think is that there were two kinds of friends, and one of the other stories that's told in this book is just how sort of the Jews created a network of relationships that they maintained over the course of their lifetimes and enabled the Jewish population in the United States to really sort of flourish together. Hellman came from this small town in Germany. But other families from that town also came to California. One of that family's name is the Haas family. It's a very well-known name in San Francisco. They used to own the Oakland A's. They own Levi Strauss and Company. And so when Hellman had his dry goods store down here, he would go to the Haas's in San Francisco to buy the goods wholesale. As Hellman flourished, he would bring those people into his networks. Like when he went to buy the Nevada Bank, the people who invested in it, many of them were Jews of long acquaintance, including the Haas's and Levi Strauss and Meyer Lehman, who was his brother-in-law, and another man named Benjamin Newgass. So what you see over the course of these people's lives lifetime is that the more accomplished they got, the more they brought their friends in. And so I think that's a very interesting story. I don't think it's atypical of an immigrant group, but it was made clear. At the same time, Hellman was careful not to be labeled as just like a Jewish businessman. He always had a board that was mixed with many people who were not Jewish. And he was... But another aspect of his personality is he made these liaisons with these very powerful men, but they inevitably ended up in sort of a falling apart of the friendship and partnership, including John Downey, the former governor of California, Henry Huntington. And so I think part of Hellman's own personal growth was in the beginning, since he was Jewish, he didn't want to be so public, so he aligned himself with non-Jewish businessmen, who were the front men of the community, but that at a certain point, he always felt that he either surpassed these men or he disagreed with their business approaches, and so there'd be some sort of break or rift. And so you see that pattern a few times.
If that curve of anti-Semitism actually does rise at the latter part of his life, is he a victim of it?
I found one clear example of it. In 1887, he tried to be elected Senate against George Hearst, and he was unsuccessful. And I found a letter written by, and this is also in my cousin's files, written by some man who was not particularly literate, saying, "Dear Mr. Hellman, I heard these two men at this country club talk about you, and they said your wife was a Russian Jew and she would travel 1,000 miles if she could save 5 cents, and they think it's really funny you think you can be senator." And, you know, actually this, I think, is a really important letter because 1887 is really, it's when Los Angeles has just experienced a tremendous boom, a real estate boom that brought in thousands and thousands of people from the Midwest. The Los Angeles population went from, 11,000 in 1880 to, 50,000 in 1890, and with a blip of 90,000 in between. And that was the beginning of sort of a dominant culture in Los Angeles, when the Midwestern set of values, the Anglo, Christian values, started to sort of control Los Angeles. And that only got more, accentuated over the next couple decades. Hellman, though, at that time was very well established. I don't think he personally suffered from anti-Semitism so much just because he was already so successful. But you can see the glimmers of that in certain periods of time.
Other than the obvious notion of Hellman arrives and then some point X decades later Hellman dies, how did you know you were done with the book?
When I couldn't stand it anymore? No. Well, how did I know that I didn't have to do more writing or the natural...
Well, how did you know that you'd done enough research? I mean, you're writing against the backdrop of the explosive arrival of California on the international stage. That's maybe 500 books to write.
Well, I think this is where being a journalist sort of really came into play. I was very interested in writing a book that was scholarly in the sense it's based on primary documents, and I believe it's got new information about Hellman. At the same time, I really wanted to write something that was readable, and so I wanted there to be a narrative arc. I wanted there to be, tension and passion and happiness and sadness. And so I didn't really leave out parts of his life at all, but I tried to craft it in a way that gave that tension to the book. And the end of his life actually is kind of sad. He was very lonely when he dies, and it sort of made this beautiful arc like that. And so it really wasn't as difficult as it might sound to figure it out.
We would like to hear from you all. We have time for questions. I think I may have said this before in this room, there is no dumb question in the history biz. There is such a thing as a long question. And so maybe we'd steer away from those in deference to everybody. But there are microphones around the room, so if you identify yourselves, then a microphone will be placed in your hand, and we can take some questions from the audience. I'd be happy to point on them, sure. There's a woman all the way back, Justin, in the turquoise.
Thank you. How much formal education did he have?
Well, he had more than most Jewish boys, but not very much by our standards. He went to school till he was 12, a Jewish school in Germany, and then he had 2 years of a secondary school where he learned some bookkeeping and things like that. But he finished schooling by the time he was 14.
Right here, Justin.
Yes, I was wondering how involved he was in the religious life of Los Angeles at that time, and also how many children did he have?
Hellman was very involved in the religious life of Los Angeles. He was a traditional Jew when he got here. He got involved with B'nai B'rith. He served as president of B'nai B'rith in 1872 and 1873 when they constructed the first synagogue, and I think he raised a lot of money for that synagogue. He was a pretty observant Jew all his life, except for he adapted his Judaism to America. For example, he kept his store open on Saturdays, and because that was sort of commonly done in the United States. And he was involved with the temple all his life. He had three children. One was called I.W. Hellman Jr. Marco is his nickname. Another daughter was Clara, and another daughter was Florence. They all grew up in Los Angeles. They went to Los Angeles Public Schools. And in fact, I just put up, there's something called the Magnus Museum in Berkeley, which has the Western Jewish History Archives, which sort of traces the contribution of Jews to the West. And they have on their webpage a link to their Flickr site where I just put up a bunch of pictures of the life of Marco Hellman Jr., including his incredibly ornate diploma from LA High School in 1887, the commencement program, and all sorts of fun things I found that I just thought, you know, it's sort of have people would like to see.
And your own genealogy goes to which of those kids?
So his son, Marco, was my great-grandfather. His son, Marco, had four children, and one of them was my grandmother, Florence. So that's the line I descend from.
Okay. Up front here, Justin. We'll take you both, so we'll just go one, two.
Actually, I don't really have a question. I wanted to thank you. We read your book at our Temple Book Club, and I didn't know what to expect, and I started it, and it was better than anything. It was like it had all the things like a great novel. It had love story. It had passion, and I really learned a lot about Los Angeles, and I just wanted to thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Is that your cousin?
Yeah. Often in your book, and twice tonight, you have mentioned Commercial Street. I wonder whether you can tell us what corresponds to Commercial Street today.
That's a hard question. Can you see me afterwards? I
bet. Is there someone in here who knows that? Yeah.
Actually, Commercial Street doesn't exist anymore. It was more or less Broadway, but mostly less. And I will talk with both of you after. At Heritage Square Museum, where I serve on the board, we are about to open a new exhibit on, it's called Paving the Way, the Stories Behind the Names of L.A. Streets. And of course, as you know, there is a Hellman. And so we talk about not just your family, but many of the other families, the names of which have been mentioned tonight, and many that are perhaps more obscure to history, but nonetheless made lasting contributions. So for people who are interested and want to pursue this, please come to the exhibit at Heritage Square Museum. It's just up the road.
Great. Thank you. Other questions? On this side, we've got several.
Could you please talk about Hellman's relationship to USC?
Good question. Sorry about that. Yes, so in 1879, when Robert Wideney was looking to form a new university, they sort of put a call out for land to be donated for the university. And Hellman was in partnership with John Downey and Osra Childs. They had bought up a lot of land on the west side of L.A., it was really funny to see the advertisements in the paper. They'd say, you know, pure fresh breezes from the ocean. So even then they had a little smog problem. And so the three men offered to donate the land to USC. They were not the only people who made an offer to donate the land. Everyone, I'm sure, thought if there's a university near our tract, it's going to increase property values. But Hellman and Downey owned something called the Main Street and Agricultural Line Railroad, which ran down to what is now Exposition Park or close to that. And so they offered to extend that, and Wideney accepted the land. So the three of them donated 308 lots for the founding of University of Southern California. Some of those lots were kept for the campus, and some were sold off to form an endowment. But he didn't stipulate in that donation that his descendants would get lifetime tickets to the football games. Big mistake.
Other questions? We've got one all the way in the back.
I was wondering whether he was involved very much in philanthropy or supportive art organizations or things like that.
Yeah, he was very philanthropic. And one of the interesting things I found out was that the Jews who arrived in Los Angeles were very philanthropic from the time they got here, and not just to the Jewish community. They raised money for the victims of the Chicago fire. Hellman donated $5,000 to the Sisters of Charity, which was a huge amount, gave money for the orphanage. He donated that land for USC. He served as a regent of the University of California for 38 years. In 1917, he donated $50,000 for scholarships. That has sort of turned into about $4 million worth of scholarships today. When his wife died, he made a huge donation to found a hospital in San Francisco called Mount Zion Hospital, and so on and so on. He was very generous.
Political party?
He was a Democrat, staunch Democrat, but it was a different thing to be a Democrat in those days.
Mm-hmm. Got a whole gaggle over here.
I was wondering about the Hellman Building. Maybe there are two Hellman buildings. Are they just named after Hellman, or
there are two existing structures in downtown Los Angeles. One is the old Farmers and Merchants Bank building, which I guess I didn't show it.
Yeah, it's there. The previous couple. Oh, there's some more pictures. Oh, you should talk about that.
Okay.
Tell us what these are. Is that Tahoe before that?
Yeah.
You should tell us that.
Okay, so, all right, sorry. So this is a picture. Hellman built probably the first large sort of private estate on the shores of Lake Tahoe in 1903. This is a picture of his house. It's now a state park called Sugar Pine Point State Park on the west side of Lake Tahoe. It's still existing. It's still very beautiful. This is a picture of his son Marcos' summer home in Oakland, which is also a city park. It's called the Dunsmere Hellman Historic Estate. And after the San Francisco earthquake, all the Hellmans and their relatives and friends came over here to sort of sit things out. Here's a picture of Hellman at Dunsmere House with his family. There's a picture of the bank after the earthquake and fire. And there's a picture of him as an old man. I'll go back to the... the building on... you can look at... So I'll just say this quickly. Okay, so he built a building on 4th and Main, which is still standing. His brother Herman had built around 1903 a building on 6th and Spring that is now the Banco Popular building, which is a really beautiful, ornate building. And I talk about this in my book. The two brothers had this falling out, and they sort of had this rival architectural projects going on.
Ah, wonderful. Just there at the corner.
Hi. I recently read a book called American Lightning, which is about the same time period, and Harrison Gray Otis features prominently in there. And the book is largely about the labor unrest during the turn, the decades in and around the turn of the last century. To what degree did I.W. Hellman participate or influence or, otherwise get involved with all of that unrest?
Mm-hmm. The bombing of the LA Times building, I think, happened in 1910, and Hellman's had moved to San Francisco by that time. There were a couple, he wasn't as conservative as Harrison Gray Otis. When the 1894 Pullman car strike happened, which was very disruptive to California, I found a letter where Hellman talked about how, if the owners of businesses were not more generous towards their employees, that they should not be surprised that people were going to be striking for a better life. So I think he was sympathetic to the issues that the working men faced. At the same time, he was a financial backer of Henry Huntington. He really is the one, I think, who brought Huntington down to L.A. When Huntington had some labor unrest in his railroads, I never saw any evidence of Hellman stepping in to stop that. And one other thing is that he put a man named Jackson Graves as sort of the spokesman for the Farmers and Merchants Bank after he had this falling out with his brother. And Jackson Graves was rabidly anti-socialist, and he spoke out very strongly against the bombings at the LA Times, and Hellman never reined him in. So I thought that suggested, that he could have acted differently. But I don't think there's such clear, he wasn't employing people the same way, so it wasn't such a clear relationship.
Okay, let's take about two more questions. Right behind you, Justin. Gentleman in the blue.
Yes, can you tell us what ever happened to the Farmers and Merchants Bank, and is it any relationship to the one in Long Beach today?
I think the name Farmers and Merchants was common in the 19th century. There was one branch of Farmers and Merchants Bank during Hellman's lifetime and afterwards, and in 1956 it was acquired by Security Pacific Bank, which actually was a bank that Hellman had helped found and fund when it was Security Trust, and then that bank was absorbed by Bank of America. So,
do you still have your little card?
You got to read the prologue to find out what happens.
Yeah, okay. One last question. We haven't gone over here. Let's go over here.
It's the gaggle.
And then we can go maybe two questions. We probably got time. If it's quick.
Yes, what caused the falling off between Downey and your great-grandfather?
Two things happened. Hellman in 1875 went to Europe at a time when there was the Bank of California in San Francisco closed its doors because of a bank panic. And there were only two banks in L.A. at the time. And Hellman was out of town, and Downey was heading up Farmers and Merchants, and he agreed to close the doors of Farmers and Merchants. And as I mentioned earlier, that a bank is only good as its reputation. And Hellman was furious that Downey had done that. And so he started to not trust his banking acumen. And also when he returned, he found evidence that Downey had given some money to a land developer and was taking a slice of the profits.
Cool. One final question. In the green. You're welcome.
Are you aware of anything that the enterprise of Wells Fargo does now or has done in recognizing Hellman?
They do. Wells Fargo, I just did an event for them on Monday. It was their 157th birthday of the founding of Wells Fargo. And, when Nevada Bank and Wells Fargo merged in 1905, that was the first merger. Wells Fargo is now made up of 10,000 separate institutions. And they try to honor the history of all those institutions. So in the scale of that, Hellman isn't huge. They do have his portrait in the History Museum in San Francisco. And I've done a couple of events for them trying to talk about Hellman. I think, Hellman was a very conservative banker. He believed in keeping 40% of his of the assets available to customers at all times, which is unusual then and extremely rare now. But I think, that sort of approach towards putting the customer first really permeated Wells Fargo, and I think a bit of it remains today. Although they were involved in sort of subprime mortgage lending, they actually came out looking better than a lot of other institutions. So I think that's because they were slightly more conservative than other banks. So that's Hellman's legacy to some degree.
Well, I hope you'll all join me in thanking Francis for...
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.